So we're reading through Luke's Gospel, and we've begun to think about what happened when Jesus visited the town of Nazareth, the town where he grew up. Remember, his foster father, Joseph, ran the carpenter shop in Nazareth. That's where Jesus lived till he was about 30 years old. But now Jesus has left home. He's been traveling around, preaching in different places. He's become famous very quickly. And now he's making a return visit to his hometown. Jesus goes into the synagogue on the Sabbath day. And the leader of the synagogue invites Jesus to read the scriptures and to preach. Now, I asked last week what people will have been expecting Jesus to say. And I'll have to repeat a little of what I said last week, because without it you can't really make sense of what happened later. The people there in the synagogue expected Jesus to congratulate them. After all, they were all Jewish people. They thought of themselves as God's special people. They looked at people from other nations and they said, look, they all worship false gods. They worship idols. They worship demons. But we're different. After all, we worship the true God. And even among Jewish people, these people Jesus was speaking to, these people were outstanding as Jews. These were the people who kept the Sabbath. These were the people who were in the synagogue. These were the most moral, the most decent people around. These were the people who took their religion seriously. So they really thought that Jesus would take this opportunity to say nice things about them. And Jesus can look around and talk about what a privilege it was to grow up in a town like this and among people like these, and what a debt he owes to them all. And alongside that, of course, Jesus can take the opportunity to denounce the wicked, to denounce the Gentiles, to speak out against the outsiders and the compromisers, to denounce the Jewish people who don't take their religion seriously, the tax collectors, all the riffraff out there, the people who haven't bothered to turn up at the synagogue today. But it's even more than that. They're expecting Jesus not just to talk about how good they are and how bad other people are. They're expecting Jesus to talk about what's going to happen to them and what's going to happen to others. Everywhere Jesus has been traveling, he's been talking about God's kingdom coming to earth, about God stepping in to bring the world as it is to an end, God setting up his kingdom and putting everything right. And they're expecting Jesus to say, yes, the kingdom is coming, and all those wicked people out there, they're going to be smashed. They're going to be swept away. They're going to be punished. They're going to be burned up. While you, the righteous, you are going to be rewarded. These people gathered there in the synagogue are really expecting Jesus to endorse them, to vindicate them, to tell them that they've got the stamp of God's approval, to tell them that they're doing fine, and that other people, the people outside, Jews who don't live up to their heritage, Gentiles, well, Gentiles full stop, that they're all going to face God's anger and ruin very soon. But what does Jesus actually say? Well, he reads these words from Isaiah, recorded for us in Luke 4:18, the Spirit of the Lord is on me, because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind, to release the oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. And then he says, verse 21, today this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing. He reads a passage from the Old Testament in which the Messiah speaks. The great king whom God had promised to send, the anointed one. And the Messiah says, I've come for ruined people. People who are so poor that they've got nothing to offer to God. People who are prisoners, trapped in their sins. People who are blind, who can't see the truth, who can't find God. People who are oppressed, who are crushed by the weight of their guilt and sin. I've come to tell those people that God is willing to be gracious to them. That this is the year of the Lord's favor. Went through those verses in much more detail last week, but that's what they're about. The Messiah proclaiming good news for sinners. And then he says, today this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing. Jesus says, what these verses are talking about, it's happening right here and now in front of you. Jesus is saying, I'm the anointed one. I'm the Messiah, I'm the King, I'm the one who does bring God's kingdom to earth. And right here and now, I'm preaching good news to poor, imprisoned, blind, oppressed, lost people. I'm here to tell you, you can be forgiven and saved. And the people in that synagogue were horrified. Jesus is talking to them as if they were the ones in need. As if they're the ones who are poor and imprisoned and blind and weighed down by sins. No, it's not just that he's talking to them as if they were those things. He's telling them that that's what they are. And he's telling them that he's the only one who can help them. He's telling them that they need him to save them, to set them free. It's the most appalling insult they've ever received. They'd have been less offended if Jesus had just gone round and spat in each one of their faces in turn. Luke says they were astonished that he should talk words of grace to them. How dare he talk to us as if we need grace? Who does he think he is? Luke says they asked the question, isn't this Joseph's son? And they all said, yep, that's who he is. That's all he is. They witnessed to him, says Luke. Not, as the NIV translated, they spoke well of him. They didn't. The very opposite. They reminded one another of where he came from. He grows up in that dirty little carpenter shop, and now he goes round talking as if he's the Messiah, far too good for people like us. He's going to set us free. Oh dear, he thinks we're blind. But he's going to teach us all to see, is he? We're all supposed to bow down to a carpenter's son, are we? Perhaps when they called him Joseph's son, they were hinting at something else as well. In a little community like Nazareth, they'd all have heard the strange rumours about how Mary got pregnant before she and Joseph got married. And how close maybe Joseph came to divorcing her. Remember, this is Joseph's son, they're saying. And Joseph didn't wait to have him, did he? Conceived out of wedlock. And now he thinks he's fit to lecture us. and call us blind and prisoners. I suppose there's no real point in speculating, but you do wonder if Jesus had come to them and had talked in the way they had expected, would they have been willing to recognize him as the Messiah, at least as a great prophet? Maybe they'd have gone that far so that they could bask in the reflected glory, you know, the local boy made good syndrome. But now they're just dismissing Jesus. He expects us to take him seriously as the Messiah. He's Joseph's son. How can the Messiah, how can the king of the whole world, be the son of a local tradesman? And Jesus knows exactly what they're going to say next. He can tell them what they're going to say next. He looks at them and he says, I know what you're going to say next. The next thing you're going to do is to quote a proverb at me. You're going to say to me, Physician, heal yourself. Jesus has been offering to heal them. He's been telling them that they are poor, but he can give them real riches. They're prisoners, but he can set them free. They're blind, but he can give them real sight. And he knows what they're going to say in reply. They're going to say, well, if you're so good at helping other people, why don't you help yourself? Physician, go on, sort out your own problems, heal yourself. As far as they're concerned, Jesus is the one who's got problems. If he really were the Messiah, well, he wouldn't be wandering round on foot from village to village, would he? He'd be riding round on a great stallion, wearing a royal robe, with a triumphant army marching behind him. And instead of that, there's this working man, still maybe showing the signs of those grueling 6 weeks in the wilderness, where he came so close to starving. No trappings of grandeur, no trappings of power. He's offering to do wonders for them. Well, why can't he at least conjure up a designer robe for himself? Physician, heal yourself. And Jesus knows what the next line after that is going to be. Do here in your hometown, or on your home territory, the word doesn't really mean town, do here in your own territory what we've heard that you do in Capernaum. They're going to challenge him. They're going to say, come on then, you do a miracle for us. We've heard about all these so-called miracles, but they're always somewhere else, aren't they? They're always in Capernaum or wherever. Well, if you can do miracles elsewhere, let's see one here. Jesus knows that that's the next line they're going to come out with. Jesus knows all the standard cheap shots that people make when they don't like what he says to them. He knows all the standard sneers that people use to dismiss him when they don't like his message. And that's all they are, they're sneers. They're just sarcastic put-downs. Physician, heal yourself. Can't even think of anything original to say. Come on, let's see a miracle then. Ever heard anybody use that one today? The sneers that people use don't change. Jesus knew in advance what sort of sneers these people would throw at him. People always bring out the same familiar cliches and imagine that they're bringing out some new, novel, clever, devastating response. Do a miracle for us. Well, do they really think that the Messiah is just going to do miracles whenever anyone demands it? You know, like a conjurer who pulls rabbits out of hats to order her children's parties. Do you really think that if Jesus did suddenly do a miracle in front of these people, that it would change anything. That they would then say, it's true. We are poor. We are spiritually bankrupt. Would they then say, it's true, we're prisoners. We're trapped in our sins. Would they then say, it's true, we're blind, we've never seen anything rightly? Would they then say, yes, we do need forgiveness, we do need grace? Seeing a miracle might just change the way they view Jesus. It might convince them that Jesus is the King, the Messiah. But it wouldn't change the way they view themselves. The problem with these people is that they're convinced that they've got no problem. They're self-satisfied. They're sure that they are morally upright. That they're clear thinking, that they're decent, that they're devout, that they're wise, that they've got God's approval. They're pleased with themselves. They're not going to listen to anyone who tells them that they've got the problem, even if he happens to be the Messiah doing miracles in front of their eyes. You know, these days we're being told all the time, aren't we, how important it is for people to have self-esteem. People, we're told, need to have a high view of themselves. So it's the job of teachers to make sure that their students have high self-esteem. And it's the job of parents to make sure that their children have great dollops of self-esteem. And it's the job of probation officers to make sure that their clients have self-esteem. Well, there may be contexts in which it's important that people should recognise their own dignity, their gifts, their strengths. But in our dealings with God, there is no room for self-esteem. You can't come before God thinking how much you've got to offer, how well you've done, what a fine fellow you are, how well you measure up compared with other people. You can't come with a high view of yourself before God, because it's not true. And God knows it's not true. The truth about ourselves is that we're petty, that we're sick, that we're selfish little creatures, that we've treated God abominably, and we've treated other people pretty horribly most of the time as well. The truth about ourselves is that we've got dark and twisted minds. That left to ourselves, we're just going to spiral down and down into everlasting ruin and misery. The truth is, we've got nothing to offer God. But we desperately need Him to help us. Self-esteem is the biggest barrier preventing people from finding God through Jesus Christ. That's why these people reacted against Jesus as sharply as they did. Now, in the case of these people in the synagogue in Nazareth, what was it that gave them this self-esteem? What was it built on? Well, more than anything, remember, we've said it already, it was built on the fact that they were Jewish. They were members of the nation of Israel. And they could point to the fact that that nation had been chosen by God to be His special nation on earth. They could point to the fact that they were different from other nations. Idolatry, almost unknown among Jewish people. Sodomy, virtually unknown within Israel. Jewish people could boast, we are different. People, of course, build their self-esteem on many different things. But that was where these people built their self-esteem. So what does Jesus say to them? We've got it here in verses 24 to 27. I tell you the truth, Jesus continued. It's the formula he uses when he's about to say something very serious. Something that people need to take with utter seriousness. I tell you, no prophet is accepted in his homeland, his own territory. You people in Nazareth, you reject me. And you give as your reason the fact that I grew up here. You dismiss me as Joseph's son. You say I can't be a prophet. Well, I won't be the first prophet and I won't be the last to be rejected in my hometown, on my home territory. And then he reminds them of two prophets in particular. Two men whom they all acknowledge to be true prophets. He reminds them of two of the very greatest prophets of Old Testament times, Elijah and Elisha. Elijah first, verses 25 to 26. I assure you, he says, that there were many widows in Israel in Elijah's time, when the sky was shut for 3.5 years and there was a severe famine throughout the land. Yet Elijah was not sent to any of them, but to a widow in Zarephath, in the region of Sidon. Now most of you here, I think, know the stories of Elijah reasonably well. So you'll know what Jesus is talking about. Elijah was a prophet who had lived hundreds of years earlier. He was a Jewish prophet, and God sent him to the nation of Israel. But did Elijah endorse Israel and say, yes, you have God's approval because you're Jewish? No, the fact is that Elijah called down God's judgment on Israel in the form of drought and famine. And God did send famine on Israel, and it lasted for 3.5 years. And all through that time, the king of Israel was trying to kill Elijah. Elijah was completely rejected by Israel. But he couldn't do it because God had sent Elijah away. God had told Elijah to take refuge in the home of a widow in a town called Zarephath in the territory of Sidon. God sent Elijah to that particular place, to that particular home, to that particular woman. Now, the thing to bear in mind is this. Sidon wasn't in the land of Israel. Worse than that, Sidon was about the most depraved place you could imagine. It was the influence of Sidon, in great part, that had corrupted Israel. Jezebel, the wicked queen, came from Sidon. This widow, whom Elijah went to stay with, came from the land of Sidon. She wasn't a worshipper of the true God at all. She worshipped the horrible, vile gods of Sidon. Gods they called Baals, fertility gods, who were worshipped with disgusting orgiastic rites. And yet God decided to send Elijah the prophet to her home. And because Elijah was living in her home, God protected her home. God made sure that that woman and her son never ran out of food in all the time that the famine continued. And when her little boy fell ill, and when he died, Elijah prayed, and God gave life back to that little boy. And best of all, that woman who had grown up in pagan Sidon, joining in the horrible worship of Baal, she came to know the living and true God while Elijah was staying in her home. She became a believer. She was saved. It's a story of pure sovereign grace. God simply chose that one woman out of millions of women. He passed by all the widows in Israel. He passed by all the widows of Babylonia and Assyria and Edom and Egypt. He passed by 99.99% of the women who lived in Sidon. And he chose one particular woman. And he sent his prophet to that woman's home. God had mercy on her. Just because he chose to. Didn't have to. He could have provided for Elijah's needs in countless other ways. But God had decided to have mercy on that one particular woman. So he sent Elijah to her. There was nothing special to qualify her. She wasn't an Israelite. She wasn't a worshipper of the Lord. She makes a point of saying to Elijah, you know, the Lord is your God, he's not mine. There's been some ugly sin in her life. She lets that slip when her son dies. She says, this has happened to bring back my sin to me, hasn't it? Widows were starving back in Israel. Children were dying. But God had mercy on whom he wanted to have mercy. The one unexpected person. The person who had nothing to commend her at all. God singled her out and saved her physically and spiritually. And it was like that again in the time of Elisha. Elisha, remember, was the prophet who took over from Elijah. Listen to what Jesus says about Elisha. And there were many in Israel with leprosy in the time of Elisha the prophet. Yet not one of them was cleansed. Only Naaman the Syrian. This is even more startling than the story of Elijah. Why? Because Naaman was the greatest enemy that Israel had. The country of Syria was at war with Israel. And Naaman was the commander-in-chief of the Syrian army. He had personally been responsible for carrying out the most brutal massacres of Israelite villages and towns. He was a brute, a savage. And yet God healed Naaman of leprosy through Elisha, his prophet. As Jesus said, there were countless lepers in Israel. And as far as we know, Elisha didn't heal one of them. Instead, he was told to heal a pagan, an enemy of Israel, an idol worshipper, a savage, genocidal mass murderer. And that's what happened. Naaman was cleansed of his leprosy. He became clean. That's a way of saying he became fit to worship God. And he did become a worshipper of the true God. Again, he was saved. Not just physical healing, but his soul was saved forever. He became a real child of God. Again, it's a story of pure sovereign grace. God passes by thousands of people who you might think were better qualified to receive special favor. And instead, God chooses to have mercy on the person who's got nothing to qualify him and who's got everything to disqualify him. If there was one person in the world who didn't deserve God to step in and have mercy on him, it was Naaman. And that was the one person that Elisha the prophet was sent to heal. Do you see? God chooses the people he's going to save. And they are often the most unlikely people in the world. Now, do you understand just how this strikes at all the self-confidence, all the self-esteem of those people in the synagogue? They're so sure. Well, if anyone is worthy, we are. If there are any rewards to be given out, we're the ones who qualify. And here's Jesus preaching to them that there are no rewards. There is only mercy. And God gives that mercy to anyone he chooses. And he withholds it from anyone he chooses. If they want to be saved, they've got to be saved the same way as the widow of Zarephath. That unclean woman with her life of sin and Baal worship behind her. They're going to have to be saved the same way as Naaman, that brutal soldier, that enemy of God's people, with blood all over his hands. If they're going to be saved, it'll be by the pure, unearned, undeserved mercy of God. If they're going to be saved, it'll be because of electing grace, the grace that chooses people who have got nothing to qualify them. Jesus preached to these people about election, about the fact that God bypassed so many people who seemed to be qualified, and how God chose the people who weren't qualified. Jesus preached the mysterious, glorious, wonderful doctrine of election. The fact that God has the right to choose whom he's going to save. And the right to pass by the widows of Israel and to save the woman of Sidon. And the right to pass by the lepers of Israel and to save Naaman the Syrian. So Jesus makes it plain that no one has any rights to God's favour. It's God who has the right. He has the right to give his favour, to give grace, to give forgiveness when and how he pleases. Well, see how these decent, respectable churchgoers reacted when they heard this. They had arrived at church that morning in such a spiritual frame of mind. What sort of frame of mind were they in by the time they'd heard Jesus' sermon out? What effect does one expect Jesus' preaching to have on people? Are they all going to be left full of lovely waves of happy emotion? All the people in the synagogue were furious when they heard this. They got up, drove him out of the town, and took him to the brow of the hill on which the town was built in order to throw him down the cliff. But he walked right through the crowd and went on his way. They wanted to stone him. They wanted to lynch him. This was the recognized way, or a recognized way, of stoning somebody. Take him to the top of a hill or a cliff, throw him down, and then hurl down stones after him, onto him. That's what they want to do to Jesus. It's what people often want to do to preachers who preach the doctrine of election clearly. How people hate that doctrine. Why? Because it strips them of all their self-esteem. It strips them of all the things that they think make them special. Here's somebody who all his life has been building up his own self-esteem, persuading himself that he's worthy, that he's decent, that he's moral. And then to be told that God owes that person nothing, and that God's entitled to pass them by, and that God's entitled to give his grace to other people who seem utterly unworthy. It's an outrage, and it stirs up rage. Is it a mistake to preach election to people? To tell them this truth about God? Jesus preached it, and that was the reaction. This fury, they want to kill him. The natural mind, the natural man hates this doctrine because it's the final, devastating blow that shatters self-esteem. It leaves no room for people to congratulate themselves on anything. It's humiliating. It's outrageous. It's horrible for the natural person. And yet for some of us, the doctrine of election has become very sweet, hasn't it? And very beautiful. It's a wonderful doctrine. It's a wonderful doctrine for people who know that they're poor and helpless, for people who know that they're prisoners and blind and guilty and lost. It was wonderful for that widow in Zarephath, wasn't it? To learn that God could choose her just as she was. That she didn't have to become Jewish. She didn't have to pay for her past of Baal worship. That God could simply have mercy on her because he chose to. Lovely for a person like that. Wonderful for Naaman to learn that God had chosen him. That although he'd been fighting against God for years, slaughtering God's people, that God had singled him out for grace. Wonderful for a man like that. Wonderful for some of you. I wonder how often, when you're on your knees praying, you find yourself just blessing God that he chose you. You find yourself saying, why me? Why me? Bewildered and yet full of joy that God should have chosen you out of so many who seemed so much more worthy. You look at yourself and you try to find something in yourself that would have qualified you to be chosen by God. You can't find anything. And you're finally left saying, it was all your grace. Oh God, how I bless you for electing grace. Paul, you remember, we read it right at the beginning of the service, said this to the Thessalonians, we ought always to thank God for you, brothers loved by the Lord, because from the beginning, God chose you to be saved. Fills Paul with delight as he thinks about God choosing people to be saved. If God hadn't chosen us to be saved, none of us would have been saved. Proud people will always hate the doctrine of election because it leaves them nothing to be proud about. But people who know that they're sinners, not just in their heads but in their hearts, people who know that they're sinners will always love this doctrine because it tells them that there's a God who can save sinners and that there's a God who does save sinners.